strongest network of universities. Yes, the Department of Education is a very, very important institution in American society for balancing out and trying to balance out and leaning into the necessity of balancing out the inequities across the public education system throughout the United States, and to try to bring them up into to level off the differences so that wealthy communities don't have overwhelmingly better schools, just, you know, way beyond the reach. And then the schools in poor districts are impoverished. Of course, states still largely oversee this. And of course, schooling in the United States, K through 12, is still predominantly funded at the lower level.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. And this is Hal Lohr with this hour's wildlife news update. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office said on social media Sunday that there would be zero tolerance for looters. Authorities are enforcing curfews in evacuation order zones and preventing entry into affected areas where deputies are enforcing curfews to prevent looting. On Instagram early this morning, Los Angeles County Sheriff Robert Luna said that some 29 people had been arrested in fire zones. The numbers include 25 around the Eaton fire and 4 near the Palisades fire, as he again reminded everyone that there would be zero tolerance for looters. FBI's Los Angeles field office reminded Angelenos in a statement on CBS News this morning that an investigation is now underway to find the operator of a private drone that collided with a firefighting aircraft on Thursday. Meanwhile, more than 900 incarcerated firefighters are working the fire line to slow the spread of flames. The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation is operating 35 fire camps where eligible incarcerated individuals volunteer to fight fires, paying inmates $5.80 to $10.24 per day, with an additional $1 per hour during emergencies. For the latest warnings, real-time maps showing automatic alerts, list of recommendations, current evacuation orders, and information as each wildfire changes, you can be found at watchduty.org. Or, recommended for up-to-date official information, you can go to CAL FIRE website at calfire.ca.gov. And for our KPFK listeners, a link for the WatchDuty app and CAL FIRE app can be found on the KPFK homepage at kpfk.org. For a list of places in LA where people can donate either funds or items, you can go to 211la.org, where you'll find a link that says fires. For more Pacifica news coverage, join us at 6 p.m. for the KPFA news, including coverage of our LA fires. For KPFK 90.7 FM, I'm Hal Lohr, and stay tuned as we now join Middle East in Focus in progress.
Only in this position because of massive supplies of U.S. weapons, backup military assets, and political support, end quote. As Netanyahu continues unrestrained in genocidally transforming much of Gaza into a no man's land, building permanent bases as signs of permanent conquest, making pretty clear that he will, as usual, continue to violate the terms of the agreement by retaining a presence in the south of Lebanon. We are incredibly fortunate today to be joined by the hosts of the popular Makdisi Street podcast, Sari, Usama, and Karim Makdisi, to discuss Lebanon, past and present. Dr. Sari Makdisi is a professor of English and comparative literature at UCLA. He has a BA in English and economics and a PhD in literature. He's also written extensively on the afterlives of colonialism in the contemporary Arab world. His most recent book is Tolerance is a Wasteland, Palestine and the Culture of Denial. Dr. Usama Makdisi is the May Ziada Chair in Palestinian and Arab Studies, Professor of History, and Chancellor's Professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He was previously Professor of History and the first holder of the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair of Arab Studies at Rice University in Houston, and has been awarded the Berlin Prize by the American Academy of Berlin. Usama's most recent book is Age of Coexistence, The Ecumenical Frame and the Making of the Modern Arab World. And Karim Makdisi is an associate professor of international politics and Director of the Program in Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. Karim was a founding member and served on the first Board of Trustees of the Arab Council for the Social Sciences, where he's also currently an associated researcher in the Critical Studies Working Group. He's currently working on a book project related to the 2006 Lebanon-Israel War and the larger United Nations framework. Together, Sari, Usama, and Karim Makdisi host the very popular Makdisi Street podcast, and it's truly an honor to welcome them all to Middle East in Focus. So welcome, gentlemen. I will start by asking, earlier this week, Michel Helou, Secretary General of the Lebanese National Bloc, and a former Lebanese parliamentary leader, wrote an op-ed at the New York Times about opportunities he feels the fall of the Assad regime in Syria present for Lebanon. So I wonder if you agree with him that the Lebanese people now have an historic opportunity for their country to finally become a united, functioning, sovereign nation, despite the enormous challenges it faces, and how you envision the results of the parliamentary presidential elections that happened on Thursday after a two-year vacancy helped or hindered that opportunity.
Karim, you go first since you're there.
Yes, hi. Okay, hi, everybody. The parliament in Lebanon just voted for the new Lebanese president, and he is the former, or now to be the former, head of the Lebanese army, Joseph Aoun, who was elected, in fact, on the second round of the parliamentary election. And the first round, he didn't actually make the required numbers of votes, in part because the Shia bloc, the Hezbollah and Amal party, the two main political parties representing basically the majority of the Shia vote in parliament, basically put blank ballots in the parliament vote. And also one of the main other Christian parties as well did the same. In the second round, there was a 2 hours between the two rounds. And there was, you know, formally meetings between Joseph Aoun, who was the head of the army, and the blocs, the head of the two blocs of the Amal and Hezbollah parties. And they seemed to have reached some kind of agreement. And then so the Shia representatives voted for him. And so he became the president of Lebanon as of an hour ago. And we're recording this on the Thursday. So this is where we are now. It's a big deal in Lebanon because, as you mentioned at the start, it's been about 2 years without a Lebanese president. There's been a massive war, obviously, over the past year and especially over the past several months in Lebanon, quite transformative, massive transformations in the region. The fall of Bashar al-Assad in Syria close by, the ongoing genocide in Gaza, you know, so there's a lot going on. And in Lebanon as well, over the past several years, there's been a total meltdown, the breakdown of the state, the financial, economic kind of disaster that happened in Lebanon. So there's been a lot of problems. So the election of the president now, in a sense, with very much under U.S. and to an extent the Saudi kind of influence, ensured that there would be a vote today and that the vote went to this president, the head of the army. So we could talk about the implications of this, but this is the kind of the big thing now.
Well, Israel and the Israeli regime obviously casts a long shadow on the list of the daunting problems that Lebanon faces, which include recovering from the destruction inflicted by the Israeli military, enforcing the fragile ceasefire agreement with an Israeli regime, which, as I alluded to, historically has rarely honored their ceasefire agreements. Can you discuss those challenges, particularly in context with the Israeli government's historic quest for expansion into Lebanon?
Well, I can try to answer that in the sense that it's quite clear that the agreement, what you're referring to as a ceasefire, is really basically a U.S. brokered cessation of hostilities, you know, at least on the part of the Lebanese, on the part of Hezbollah. And the Israelis have been violating this every, as far as I'm aware. Karim can correct me if I'm wrong, but basically every single day. And so Israeli impunity, Israeli arrogance, Israeli bombardments, Israeli violations of Lebanese territory, airspace. And of course, the Israelis are still in occupation of chunks of Lebanese territory, significant chunks of Lebanese territory. And so the question is, you know, what does the election of a new president in Lebanon who's under the U.S. Saudi auspices mean for the will Israel withdraw now from the rest of Lebanon? Well, what about Gaza? What about the rest of Palestine? What about the situation in Syria? I mean, there's no such thing, it seems to me, as an analysis of Lebanon that can be separated, honestly, from the rest of the region. And that's where we are right now. So I think, Karim, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the U.S., the new president is going to be tasked or expected by the U.S. to direct all his energy and force at suppressing and crushing any form of resistance in Lebanon to U.S. and Israeli hegemony. That's my sense.
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, this is the debate that's going on now. I don't think it's quite that extreme. Obviously, we'll have to see what happens. But I don't think the Israelis like this former head of the army, who's now the president, Shadar Fahon. The Israelis have killed several members of the Lebanese army just over the past few months, and they've been, you know, they've targeted Lebanese army positions over many years while he was the head of the army. So just because he's quite close to the Americans doesn't mean that he's close to the Israelis in that kind of way. So what's interesting, and I said this at the beginning, was that there seems to be an agreement as well between him and, you know, let's say representatives of Hezbollah and some of the other groups in the parliament to make sure that the understanding of the truce and the agreements on the Lebanese side, which really stems back to this UN resolution, the Security Council resolution 1701, that ended the war in 2006, that remains the kind of the core issue that all Lebanese agree to. And that the idea is that there would only be the Lebanese army that have its weapons south of the Litani River. So that's the key thing that will ensure that you don't end up in what you were saying, the possibility of that the army's role is to kind of go out and try to create massive problems with Hezbollah on behalf of the Americans and Israelis. I don't see it like that. I think some people wanted it to go in that direction. I don't think it'll go in that direction. I think there is a kind of internal agreement as of now. The implementation, let's see. But yes, I agree with it. The Israelis have now violated this truce over 1,000 times now, as you know, over the past 2 months. It hasn't even been the 60 days yet. So it's been over 1,000 violations that have been documented. And even now, as the elections were taking place, the drones were going over Lebanon, and they attacked two villages in the south as this was going on, as the elections were going on in Lebanon. So I do think they're going to withdraw. I do think they're going to, the Americans will pressure them to withdraw in the sense that this person, Aoun, you know, is close to the United States. So it makes sense that things will calm down here, that there'll be some kind of stability, that the army presence will increase south of the Litani River. I think this is very important. And I think that's important for the whole country in order to be able to have some kind of pause, some kind of idea for reconstruction and you know, some kind of vague sense of normalcy over the coming months. And then we'll see from there.
You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK Radio from Los Angeles. I'm Lesti Chandler, enormously grateful to be joined today by the prolific academic nephews of Edward Said and the hosts of the very popular Makdisi Street podcast, Sari, Usama, and Karim Makdisi, discussing this pivotal moment for Lebanon following their long postponed presidential elections on Thursday. Sari, I wonder if you want to chime in commenting on what you expect from the frighteningly hawkish incoming Trump administration, currently refusing to rule out the use of military force to take over control of Greenland and to retake the Panama Canal. What do you think the chances are that he's going to hold, or the administration will hold, the Israelis to these agreements and not stir up more trouble?
Honestly, basically zero STR. I don't think there's going to be any difference between the Trump administration and the Biden administration. I think when it comes to U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, that's determined by domestic pressures in Washington itself, not by national interest or anything like that. And so even a volatile personality like Trump, you know, what he's able to do is determined by powers that are more powerful than him even. And that's the same with Biden. So I honestly don't see any difference between the one and the other. They're all pretty much the same. The U.S., honestly, this is here we are, you know, at the moment we're having this conversation,
There are massive wildfires all around Los Angeles. I mean, a major American city is seriously threatened at this point, as other American cities like New Orleans have been in recent years. And the U.S. needs to seriously reconsider its policy because it seems to be destroying itself in order to prop up a regime that's engaged in genocide in Palestine. And I think it really needs to get its priorities in order. And for example, maybe if we weren't spending $30 billion assisting the Israeli genocide in Gaza, maybe we'd have more money to spend on firefighting here in Los Angeles, for instance. And you know, one can multiply that in all kinds of ways. I think it's something all Americans should be thinking about, is who determines our policy, in whose interest do our foreign policies serve? And I could tell you the answer is not those of the United States or of the American people.
But hopefully these events that also we should mention are at least partially a result of climate change will awaken the American public into how our money is being spent. For example, here in Los Angeles, a lot of money was cut from the budget of the fire department and given to the police. Clearly, that is going to have political ramifications as well. So I'm glad you brought it up, Sari. You know, as an outside observer from another starkly divided nation, it seems that overcoming sectarianism in Lebanese society, which is still polarized, is another considerable challenge that Lebanon faces. Can you guys discuss your assessment of that challenge and how you see it possibly playing out?
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, sectarianism obviously is an issue in Lebanon, but I think it's important for us to recognize the fact that in Lebanon there's also, and in the region, there's also countervailing, there's always been countervailing currents, coexistence, pluralism, and so on and so forth. Those are really important sort of aspects to culture in that part of the world, coexistence, pluralism, and the idea of people living together of different faiths and backgrounds and ethnicities. So I think that's really important not to over-exaggerate the question of sectarianism, and also to recognize that sectarianism alone, although it is a real issue, is not more important than corruption, than U.S., as Sadi and Karim were mentioning, the catastrophic U.S. foreign policy in the region that has served Israel and Israeli expansionism, Israeli destruction, the obliteration of villages and towns and homes. Karim mentioned the financial crisis in Lebanon and the utter corruption of the banking sector in cahoots with the state and the policy elites in Lebanon. Those are all real issues, it seems to me, that need to be tackled, you know, and need to be confronted and acknowledged far more than just this abstract thing called sectarianism, which of course is an issue, but it's not the most important issue.
Anybody else want to chime in there?
No, I agree totally. I think the way Osama kind of puts it, especially the way he frames it historically, is very, very important. And I would just add, in terms of what's going on now, it's interesting always when you look at the Lebanese political scene, even now, even in the elections of the Lebanese president in the parliament itself, you'll see that the main blocks that are opposing each other or not are not necessarily the sectarian ones. I mean, it's actually the main Christian party is the one that was most opposed to the new president that was elected, who's of course Christian. So it's not, you know, the question of sectarianism gets, I think, overblown in the political analysis. It's very important, but it's overblown in terms of its overall impact.
You know, it's estimated that about 1.5 million Syrians who live in Lebanon, which is approximately 25% of the population, and now they have the possibility of returning to Syria. Do you see a mass migration out of Lebanon in the near future? And how do you see that affecting other difficult challenges that you've laid out that the new Lebanese government faces?
Yeah, I think there's enormous, enormous list of things that the new president has to kind of deal with, bearing in mind that this is also a mixed system in Lebanon. So you now need to have a government that's formed. That's going to take some time. And then you need the cabinet to be formed and the ministers. You know, you're going to have a lot of issues before you get to have a new government in place. They're going to be the ones that have to deal with a very large list of reforms, issues that need to be dealt with internally, the economic situation, the financial situation, the political, the security, questions of borders in the south and in the north and the east, questions of the gas, the oil resources, electricity, all sorts of issues that have been pending for many, many years. The refugee issue has been massive. As you know, there have been over a million Syrian refugees in Lebanon, for the past decade or so. I think it's not clear, but there's certainly been, over the past several months of the war in Lebanon, I think there was quite a few. We don't know the numbers. I don't know the numbers. Quite a few that did go back, that crossed back into Syria because it was safer there at that point than in some parts of Lebanon. But right now, of course, there's a lot of countries, including Lebanon, including Turkey, including other areas that, of course, are reassessing the refugee situation that needs to go through the UNHCR, the refugee agency that the UN deals with. And hopefully over the coming months, the refugees will be able to return to their country in Syria, and Lebanon will have to kind of deal with what is already massive problems with its own population, let alone dealing with a refugee population that made Lebanon per capita one of the biggest refugee receivers in, globally. So there's a lot of issues that need to be dealt with.
Anything to add, Osama?
No, I agree with Kerim. I mean, it's the financial and the sort of the political, costs or the situation in Lebanon cannot sort of, and should not actually take precedence over the reality of the human sort of suffering of all these refugees, not just Syrians, of course. There are Palestinian refugees. There are other refugees in Lebanon, but the Syrians obviously have been the largest number in recent years and have faced extraordinary discrimination in Lebanon, but also this requires a much larger sort of effort on the part of the region and the international community to actually help resolve this extraordinary situation, because the refugee flows in the Middle East have been part and parcel of the catastrophe of the last, generation.
And weaponized, of course, also weaponized.
And weaponized, exactly.
We must add that.
Well. Yeah.
Not to mention the climate. The ways that climate in that region, which is rarely discussed, has also added to it. So I wonder, you guys, is there a deep Lebanese leadership bench from which to form a new government who can help lead this long divided society, communities dominated by fear of one another, and a system that was wrought with corruption and, clearly served warlords' appetites for power rather than creating a government featuring inclusive representation to benefit society?
Naeem can speak to that, but I think it's quite clear to me, if you just look at the parliament and who's the head of the parliament right now, the Speaker of Parliament, and you see it's a warlord, who's now, I don't even know how old he is without being ageist, but just the idea of the same figures, the same men, basically, who've led the country to catastrophe, continue to rule over the country or large sectors of it. It doesn't fill me with any form of optimism I think I am optimistic at the level of individuals. I am not optimistic whatsoever at the level of the Lebanese political system that's now subordinate to U.S., and Gulf pressures, let alone Israeli domination, in the south. So, or at least like the Israeli will to domination. It's not clear that the Israelis will be able to dominate. But, none of these, let alone the financial, as Kenny mentioned, the financial catastrophe, the corruption, all these other things, Lebanon is not a country with any meaningful sovereignty. And so the idea that we can talk about Lebanon, as I said, independent of all these other external pressures, especially the U.S., which, Kerim, correct me if I'm wrong again, has a massive embassy in Lebanon. And I don't think we can sort of analyze Lebanon separate from, all these other factors.
Yes, in terms of the embassy, I think from what I know, it's the most expensive embassy of any U.S. embassy in the world. And I think the second largest one. It's over, I think, $1.2 billion. In fact, it started with President Obama, I think, was the one who gave the order. And it's just only recently been completed. But no, I think it's important to separate two things. I think everybody in Lebanon understands that this is the beginning of a very new phase. But to go to what Osama was saying about sovereignty, I disagree a little bit. I think it's very clear that if you look around the countries in the neighborhood, the Israelis, you'll find only one country that's been able to assert its sovereignty in its own country, meaning in this case in South Lebanon, and that's the Lebanese. Through the resistance, through also, but, you know, with support of the Lebanese army and other forces, they were able to, first of all, ensure that the Israelis left Israel after left Lebanon after 20 years of occupation. And then each time they've launched a war and tried to reoccupy, the resistance has ensured that they've been unable to occupy large parts of South Lebanon. This happened as well now. So the resistance fighters in South Lebanon, even over the past few weeks and months, were able to resist an absolute massive invasion with a very clear intent to occupy South Lebanon. We see what happened in Syria, where as soon as something happened, the Israelis were expanded from their current occupation, the Golan Heights, and they went further, quite close to Damascus and took Mount Hermon and other areas. The same thing, of course, in Gaza and the West Bank, in South Lebanon for over 100 years. They tried it again a few months ago or a few weeks ago. The resistance blocked them from that. So I think that's important to separate that from the internal Lebanese idea, which is that we're in a new phase, that Hezbollah as such has been defeated at the political front in the sense of they're much weaker than they were before the war. I think that's very clear. That's separate from their resistance forces in South Lebanon per se, separate to the leadership and the political party, which has definitely suffered. And they had to make all these compromises, which enabled this Joseph Aoun, the former head of the army, to become president today. So they're not in an easy situation. There's a lot of things that need to be done. But Lebanon is still a place where you need to get a lot. It's very difficult to have, you know, like authoritarianism, because it needs to spread around, not just the different sectarian groups, but the different region parts of Lebanon, the different kinds of politicians, different types of people. You have American influence, you have Saudi influence, you have Qatari influence, you have still some kind of Iranian influence. So you have various influences, Turkish influence now as well. So all this kind of combines to both allow a lot of opportunity, because Lebanon is very smart. There's a lot of capabilities, a lot of people that can fix things, can build things, can do things. But there's a lot of this interference, and it's such a small country that it doesn't take very much to kind of, you know, create problems. So it's a new phase. There's a lot of potential, a lot of possibility, but I think we don't know. And let's see what happens over the coming weeks.
Well, we'll all be tuning in to Makdisi Street to hear updates on how it all develops. I can't thank you guys enough for taking the time to join us. And, you know, we'll keep listening to Makdisi Street. On Thursday, as discussed, Lebanon chose a new president, Army Chief Youssef Aoun, ending a power vacuum that lasted for over 2 years. His election comes just weeks after a tenuous, quote unquote, ceasefire agreement halted 14 months of fighting between Israel and Hezbollah as the country seeks international aid for reconstruction. Quote, a new phase in the history of Lebanon begins today, Aoun told the chamber after he was sworn in. Following his election, Al Jazeera's Zeina Khoder, reporting from Beirut, commented that Aoun really is a favorite candidate of the international community, but also does enjoy support in Lebanon. Once again, I want to thank our guests, Sari Usama and Karim Makdisi, hosts of the wonderful and very popular Makdisi Street podcast. I also want to thank Mark Maxwell for his production support today. Our theme song is the overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm SD Chandler, wishing everyone in the Southland safety from the LA fires, thanking you for your continued support of KPFK and for taking this time to put the Middle East in focus.
Thank you for tuning in to your community radio station during this very difficult time for our great city of Los Angeles. Please know that KPFK is committed to keeping you both informed and safe. You can visit the station's website, kpfk.org, for trusted resources, timely updates, and essential information.
diplomacy, then everything changed in terms of how it is that we can talk about settler colonialism, forms of violence. What does it mean to talk